Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Wednesday, March 4th. We have one topic on our agenda, and there are lots of seats in the front. There's plenty of room if anyone wants to move up. The topic, I'm opening an informational meeting, an update on the broadcaster tax policy. There is a policy and a bill that has been under consideration in the legislature during this session, and we'd like to have an update, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the so-called interstate broadcasters tax policy in Senate Bill 1529, I think the last time the House Revenue Committee heard this was in November, a preview of a report that LRO put out as a result of Senate Bill 193 last time and then 2019 session. So that report got released in December. And throughout February, the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee tackled this issue and ultimately passed 1529, which is sitting still over on the Senate side. But Kate was going to give a kind of a refresher of the interstate broadcaster taxation policy. There was a lot of negotiation, a lot of work put in between taxpayers and the Department of Revenue. And what you have before you in that bill is the policy, and Kate's going to give a little bit of background, a little more overview to refresh.
Great. Thank you.
Sure. So I'm Caitlin Harker with the Legislative Revenue Office, for the record. As Chris described today, I'll give a brief overview of what we're talking about and then specifically describe the policy in that Senate bill. So to take a step back, first, I just want to start talking about key terms in corporate taxation. And today, we're talking specifically about what's referred to as the corporate income tax. And so we're talking about how to apportion income. So first, there's this question of nexus. In general, nexus means whether or not a state has the ability to tax a taxpayer. We believe that this is kind of an area where there was a lot of tension in prior years with industry, but it seems like that's been resolved now. But whether or not the taxpayer can be taxed. Second, we have federal taxable income. This is the amount of income that's taxable at the federal level. And this is the amount, this is Oregon's starting point for apportioning income. And so the process of apportionment is trying to take that federal income amount and apportion it or spread it out across states in an appropriate manner. As Oregonians, our apportionment factor is Oregon sales divided by U.S. sales. So in general, most businesses, this is the case. However, there are these kind of one-off exceptions, and interstate broadcasters is an industry where one of these exceptions exists. And so we're not going to use the sales factor here. We'll use a different factor. But again, we're trying to determine the portion of federal taxable income that Oregon can tax. And so when talking about this, just at a very high level, I want you to be aware of the changes that have happened recently and in history. So in 1989, that was the first time that the legislature specifically called out this industry rather than treating it like all other industries. So in 89, this change was made. And from 1989 to 2013, the industry apportioned income using what's referred to as the audience method, which means that you would take your audience or subscribers in Oregon over your audience in the U.S., and that would be your apportionment ratio. Excuse me. In 2013, I think it was the 2013 session, the industry came forward and had some concerns about their ability to identify the audience given changes in technology. So I'll go through an example later that talks about Netflix, but if you think about a network that's licensing to Netflix, perhaps in that case, the network doesn't actually know how much or who is watching their material because of this tiered structure. So in 2014, Oregon switched to the commercial domicile method of apportionment. This method assigns sales to a state based on where the commercial domicile, which is typically the headquarters of a company, is located, or in the case of subscribers, the address of that individual. So that method was in place between 2014 and 2019, and LRO did a few reports during that, I think two reports during that time period on this method. Now it's 2020, and if no legislation passes, we will be back into the audience method that's listed in the top panel there, and I'll describe that in more depth in upcoming slides. But also this is a chance to change policy and determine what the policy should be going forward. So that's why there are some question marks there.
Madam Chair, just a quick question. Thank you. We're going back to it because it's, I missed what you said about the air, it's sunsetting?
So Chair Nathanson, Representative Ken Geyer, that's a great question. I should have been a little bit clearer. From 2014 to 2019, those changes were made on a temporary basis, mm-hmm. pending the LRO reports. And because of things like litigation and the lag in gathering data, it took a long time to get to a place where the legislature was ready to make a change. So those were temporary provisions. Okay, so what I'm gonna do now is describe how we at LRO have been thinking of this industry and how it functions. And then in subsequent slides, I'm gonna use this diagram to indicate what the bill does. So of course, please stop me if there are any questions. So we've kind of thought about this industry description in two stages of production. So first, starting with the content production. Content producers typically are national networks or cable networks, or they could be consumer direct entities. National networks are what you would think of traditionally as networks, so things like NBC, ABC, Fox, and CBS. Cable networks are typically networks that are only available via a cable subscription. So those are the other channels that you get through your cable or similar subscription service. And consumer direct would be something like Netflix, a Netflix original, for example. They've created their own content and they're giving it directly to the consumer. So for a second, I'll just talk about the national networks. So national networks are going to license content and also place national advertising on cable networks. So that's the kind of the top portion through here. Then that cable network provides the content and local advertising to customers in exchange for subscription fees. So the viewer, which we believe is the end user, is sending a subscription fee to the cable network, and the cable network is sending license fees to, the cable company is sending license fees to the national network. So this is kind of how the revenue stream works. So that gets to the second panel here, which is distribution. So typically things are distributed in one of four ways. First,
I'm going to stop you for a minute. I want to make this sort of real world mm-hmm. For a minute. So I pay money to Comcast. Mm-hmm. I actually do. I subscribe. So I pay a really large monthly fee to Comcast and get a bunch of channels. Mm-hmm. But I don't watch all those channels, and I don't spend 24 hours a day watching television. I watch only some things, but then Comcast is paying something to networks or other, whatever you call other companies. Mm-hmm. And part of this is about, depending domicile or audience or whatever, who figures out what the consumer actually consumed in the way of a product or service?
So, Chair Nathanson, that's a great question. And briefly stepping forward, the policy in place is trying to address kind of that exact mm-hmm. issue. So in terms of Comcast, if you're a subscriber on Comcast part, they have your address, and so they know where to attribute that sale. In terms of a network licensing to Comcast, presumably, in that case, Comcast is providing them information on either where the audience is or they're providing information to third-party rating services. And so then Comcast can use, the network could use those ratings to determine audience. However...
But it's not because they knew specifically, it's just statistically.
Yes.
About this many people were watching this thing.
Yes.
And for my neighbor who has a satellite dish... It's the same arrangement.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we just spoke about cable and satellite. There's also telecom provision of or distribution of content, and then also things can be distributed via the internet. This is becoming very common nowadays. So something like Netflix or Hulu. So for example, I don't subscribe to Comcast. I don't have a cable bill, but I do have Hulu and Netflix and other direct-to-consumer methods of viewing content.
And we have a question. Yes.
Thank you. So does advertising via the internet on non-traditional kinds of engagement with the internet, like Facebook, social media. Does that fit into this bucket?
So Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, that is a great question. So under current law, I believe it potentially could. So current law's definition of broadcasting is this one-way signal. And so to advertise via the internet, I believe you'd be transmitting a one-way signal. However, I do not think that's the intent of at least the Senate committee when we've been discussing this. And I believe that the market-based sourcing rules that we have in place now actually delineate out those different types of revenue. And so I'm not familiar enough to know if they have advertising online specifically. And that perhaps, I don't know if Chris or Deanna might be able to answer that in more detail. But I think it's possibly in there under current law.
Sure. Madam Chair, I would request that we sort of put a pin in this subject for a discussion at a future time. I think we should be, I asked the question because I don't think it quite fits in here, but I think we absolutely should be looking at tax policy around that kind of advertisement.
Thank you.
Okay.
I see notes being made.
Okay. And so, again, this is how we've been viewing the industry. So we think about content production, then the distribution of that content, and then viewers finally seeing that content. There's also this consumer direct method, which we've talked about here and there, and that's something like Netflix. So in terms of talking about policy and the policy changes, I first want to describe where we are in terms of our current baseline, because any change that we're considering will be in reference to this. So like we've discussed briefly, if nothing passes, current law in 2020 is the audience method. And by audience method, I mean essentially the audience method that was in place between 1989 and 2013. So that's our baseline for estimating any type of change and for considering policy changes. So I want to make that really clear as we move forward. But for example, if there's no legislation, there will be no revenue impact relative to the baseline, because we're just comparing the baseline to itself. Or another way to say this is whatever we analyze in terms of different policies, audience method is the baseline of comparison. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is the same chart you saw earlier. What I'm trying to show is visually, how do we tax these, which receipts do we tax given the current method? So we're still talking about current law. This is still the baseline. So all of the receipts that I have made inside this little rectangle, those are all subject to apportionment using the audience factor. And those are broadcasting receipts, like we described in the previous, like I described in the previous section. But as a result of the Comcast decision that came in 2018, it would also be apportioning other receipts except for tangible personal property and real property using the audience method. And this was a finding of the Oregon Supreme Court in that Comcast case in 2018. So baseline, in that sense, is all of a broadcaster's receipts except for tangible personal property and real property, because those two are called out specifically in statute. And so it's this big, this broad bucket of receipts when we're talking about this. So that's our current baseline. Now I'm going to transition into what the Senate bill as amended proposes. So first thing is that if we go back to that slide and you look at the rectangle, it's getting smaller. So rather than apportioning all receipts using the audience method, we're going to try to deal with cases where perhaps the audience isn't clear or it isn't available to the taxpayer. And we're also going to provide an option to not include that larger bucket of receipts. So one thing that 1529A does is it says we're only going to tax your broadcasting receipts, we're only going to apportion your broadcasting receipts using the audience calculation. And we're going to separate out cases where you might not know your audience. And so focusing on that for a minute, in our discussions with the Department of Revenue and then with industry while working on this bill, one of the things that came up on industry side is that they do not always get they maintain that they do not always get customer information as a part of their licensing contract. So I think they've testified to the fact that in their view, audience is difficult to maintain or for them to provide enough information because they might not actually have information on ratings or audience. And in that case, if no information is provided, then I believe the department uses population because they don't have anything else. And this is where some of the friction between taxpayers and the department has come up. And so I think the MPA, when we were discussing with them, they said, look, if it's a national network or a cable network licensing to one of these traditional distributors, we have third-party information and we get information on their audience. So right now, these are things that they feel comfortable that they can provide, in general, audience numbers on. But also, there's additional statutory guidance about when to use population related to these receipts, and it says that things like third-party ratings or information from the taxpayer's actual books and records can be used prior to using population. So this is kind of one area of compromise or confluence for the MPA and DOR. So that's the first thing that it does.
I'd like to talk about population for a minute.
Sure.
I want to make sure I understand it from your point of view. I have met with several people when the option or the technique of using population came up, but I have never had an opportunity to ask you about it in this venue. Population means, for example, if Oregon's population is 1% of the United States population, that would be the apportionment. Well, 1% of everything nationally must be attributed to Oregon. Does that have, though, an underlying assumption that Oregon's population is all subscribing to all of these things and viewing them?
So Chair Nathanson, yes, that's a correct description of population. And yes, I do think it has that underlying assumption because the national networks, so NBC, CBS, ABC, and Fox, I believe you can access still via digital antenna without a subscription. And so there's a potential that everyone in Oregon could effectively be subscribing to those networks, given that they are provided openly.
Okay, benefiting from the availability of that content.
Exactly.
The content is available to them. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so again, the first thing it does is it says, we're just gonna consider broadcasting sales and we'll use the audience method there. And then we're gonna provide a little bit more statutory guidance. The second thing that I wanna describe that Senate Bill 1529, this should say A, it provides an election for taxpayers to essentially use current law. So it says, if you'd like to, you can still apportion all of your receipts using the audience method. So this slide is effectively what we're doing right now. And so this portion would have no revenue impact because it's an election to do exactly what they would be expected to do in the absence of legislation. And this is in line with that Comcast case that I mentioned earlier. So just pointing out again, this reverts the taxpayer or returns the taxpayer to current law. Then the third thing that I wanted to talk about, and this is kind of the largest change I would say in terms of policy change, is so now we're gonna talk about situations where industry maintains that they do not have information on audience or subscribers. And they've maintained that that is the case because of their contracts with who they're licensing to and that they're not provided that information back because the company may feel that it's proprietary. That company might also not be reporting to third-party ratings information to other agencies. And so there might be no way for the taxpayer to get those receipts, to get the audience, excuse me. And so, instead of using population, which I think is the industry's concern, these receipts would be apportioned using this 0.6% as the numerator of the sales factor, multiplying that 0.6% by these receipts that fall into this category where they cannot identify their customers. And so this is, I think, in talks with MPA and getting Chair Nathanson to your earlier question about, well, how can I always know This, we believe, is where industry is really saying, we really don't know here. And so here's a proposal to deal with that case that isn't using the population ratio.
So rather than using some sort of validated statistical information, absent data, here's a number. Arbitrary is the wrong word. I'm having trouble thinking of the right word, but we're just going to pick a number. It's based on something. There's a rational reason for picking that number, but here's a number we propose using.
Chair Nathanson, I think that's correct. I believe in testimony in the Senate that the MPA described this number, how they went about choosing it, as a compromise between what they're paying under commercial domicile, or what they were paying, and what they would pay under population. And I think they've testified that this number is somewhere in between there. But how you described it is correct. Okay. So I'm just going to summarize the three things we talked about with those images. So first, what does 1529A do? Well, first it says we're going to apply the audience method to only your broadcasting sales. So we're taking that larger bucket from the Comcast case and making it a little bit smaller. And we're going to provide additional statutory guidance for how to calculate the audience factor to hopefully reduce some of that friction between the department and taxpayers. Number two here is allowing taxpayers to elect to essentially use current law, meaning they can elect to apply their audience apportionment ratio to all of their receipts except for tangible personal property and real property. And this is the one that deals with the Comcast case finding that we talked about earlier. And then number three, this is the 0.6%. And this is the one that is where industry maintains that they do not have information on their audience. And so they, in this case, we say, so for licensing to subscription services or advertising on subscription services, we're going to take 0.6% multiplied by those receipts as the numerator for the sales factor. And these are the three, I think, essential changes to policy in that bill. And that's all I had. So I'm happy to answer any questions or provide more information if I can.
Representative Marsh.
My mind is going off in all different possible applications and questions here, which really start back with how do we define broadcasters and what's content. What I'm thinking of is things like I subscribe to the New York Times and some other national publications. When they come up on my internet application, there are ads, always ads associated with them. They're producing news content. The news content is mostly written, but is increasingly verging into video content. At the same time, a legitimate content, I mean, a traditional content would be MSNBC or Fox News, I assume that would, they're in the traditional broadcaster bucket. But when do all of these other media start to merge in terms of, you know, the content parallels, and how do we start to, do we need to have a larger conversation about how to deal with all of this? I mean, just to make it more complicated, I think it's going to be increasingly difficult to separate out these different kind of providers from the traditional notion of what's a broadcaster.
So I think for context, part of what we have, our core system is a market-based sourcing. Mm-hmm. So we just went to that in the 2017 session. So since 2018, we've been on this market-based sourcing for intangibles and services, and that's largely what I think you're getting at, is that's the base for it. Mm-hmm. The policy that is in 1529 is a special policy, if you will, related to what had been termed interstate broadcasters and some of the traditional programming, the TV shows. But under current law, there is some concern, and we've had a lot of conversations with industry, with DOR, about what's current law right now. Keeping in mind, 1529 isn't law.
Right.
And under current law, a broadcaster is defined as any one-way signal. So that seems to capture a lot of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to speak for DOR, but when LRO looks at it, like, well, that's a very broad definition, and all of these other businesses certainly seem to fit the definition under current law, of an interstate broadcaster. And I don't know that those businesses would consider themselves interstate broadcasters. Right. And so that's one of the concerns about that definition that exists in current law and what may happen and any sort of work DOR may or may not do down the road as the policy develops, depending on if this gets passed or if it doesn't get passed. But I think it's helpful to keep in mind that market-based sourcing is really trying to get at that notion of economic nexus. And if a business anywhere in the country is making money off of Oregonians, that's that economic nexus, and that's what triggers the taxability. Mm-hmm. Which is different. Prior to 2018, we had a cost of performance, which I don't know that we can get into it if you want, but I don't know that you want to get into it. And it's very different now. So the market-based sourcing, I think, is a more intuitive way to think about that taxation.
If I could just add as well, Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh. So kind of two things here. One, given the short time frame, we did talk with MPA and DOR, like Chris mentioned, about all of this, and specifically with MPA about whether there was a better definition mm-hmm. that would be clearer about their type of business. And they did provide feedback, which was that this is kind of a common definition across states in their view, but we did add two words, which I think are programming through a one-way signal. So it's not just transmitting a one-way signal. And I'm talking specifically about in the Senate bill. So it's transmitting programming through the one-way signal. But again, to your point, it becomes what is programming. So if I am the New York Times and now I make a video, is that programming or is it content? And the other thing I will say, just to echo a little bit what Chris said, the market-based sourcing rules that the department has adopted, I think, are based on the MTC rules. And they are over 20 pages, and they have lots of in-depth examples that talk about, okay, I'm a news corp and I'm doing this, or I'm an advertising corp and I'm doing this. And so I think to some degree, the market-based sourcing rules are there. But like Chris said, that's kind of the backdrop for this special exception, which would make these taxpayers tax differently than that.
Podcasts.
Yeah, there you go.
What's a podcast?
But there are podcast apps. There are podcasts on certain kinds of topics. I don't even know how to describe this, but where does that fit into this? It's transmitting something one way.
Yes. So, Chair Nathanson, yes, I think that's correct. This is my view. I don't want to speak for the department, but if the definition is transmitting programming through a one-way signal, I would think that at least the podcast that I listen to, they're programming in that similar. I would think that falls into that category. Additionally, there's advertising on podcasts as well, often. And so that's kind of another layer of this. But again, that's my view, and I'm not sure if the department would interpret the one-way programming differently or not.
So I have another question, and I've thought for about 30 seconds about this, and I think it's fraught with danger that I even raised the topic, but mm-hmm. here we go. It's very clearly one-way electronic signal. I listen to Pandora, and I pay for a subscription so that I get a certain level of service without ads. And I don't pay for the most expensive service, which gets you even more features. But one of the features of using Pandora to listen to music is you can click on a thumbs up or a thumbs down. I like this or I don't like this. If you don't like it, you're not going to get, you won't have to hear it anymore. If you like it, supposedly you'll hear it more often, and it will start to learn what kinds of things you like. How does it learn that? Because it's collecting data. Well, it started out as a one-way thing to send music to me to listen to. But now I've clicked on something, so it's no longer only a one-way service. Is this thing subject to this statute, or does it fall under some other statute, or does it not qualify for anything? But there are probably many other kinds of content or applications mm-hmm. where you're sending something back mm-hmm. so it can learn something about you or send you more information.
So Chair Nathanson, I think that's a, again, in my view, not speaking for anyone else, I think that's a reasonable concern that feedback could be picked up in this. I'm not sure what income would be apportioned from that since there's no income. And so I don't know that it would be a practical issue, maybe just an issue in theory.
I think it was embedded in part of the two-way signal encompasses the one-way signal.
Well, and I think so specifically in the Comcast case, one of the findings was that a two-way signal, but in that case, Comcast, I think is, I'm not sure if you're sending something back. I guess you implicitly are. But yes, the court found that a two-way signal is two one-way signals. And so
yes.
Getting around that, I'm not sure that would apply to
all
everything.
Right. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I was just going to remind Caitlin that, yes, that is what that has actually been litigated, and the court actually has already ruled that it is a one-way signal no matter what. It doesn't have to only be a one-way signal.
Good. Thank you. So, thank you.
So I think there are, as probably going through everybody's minds, there are a lot of issues here, and we've had a lot of discussions, and we've gone down a lot of rabbit holes about, okay, well, then so-and-so, following this logic, then so-and-so is a broadcaster. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no way they consider themselves a broadcaster,
right.
Even more tangentially than some of these examples. And as in the report and conversations, one of the challenges was trying to come up with legislation that would be amenable to a rapidly changing environment. And even if Kate could go back to some of her slides, the slide that had the consumer direct, we could eventually be going down a point where everything is consumer direct. Mm-hmm. And in consumer direct, I'm not sure that apportionment needs to happen because they know where your address is. And so they know that I'm a Netflix subscriber and I live in state X. But I think a lot of these questions that come to mind are issues for further discussions in the revenue committees. I don't know that we have answers to all of them right now, but especially in a rapidly changing industry, how does the tax policy keep up with those changes?
Mm-hmm. Well, this, from the explanations I'm hearing today, this seems like a logical and reasonable solution for the issue that was before us for this year. Because we need to do something. We need to settle this for now because there was something temporary in place. And this seems appropriate for the technology and recent litigation, anything that we have found out, it seems reasonable to get to this point for now. I hope we don't need to go back. I don't think we need to go back and redo things in a major way. I just want to be real cognizant that the landscape is changing rapidly, and we need to stay on top of it. Representative Marsh.
I would agree. And actually, I would also agree with Chris's comments around the consumer direct. I mean, that's the way the future is going. Consumer direct already has a significant part of the market, I would assume, although I haven't seen the numbers. And then you're into a bucket that is ginormous, figuring out what qualifies as consumer direct. We may know where those consumers are, but then the question becomes, who are the broadcasters, or what have the broadcasters become? Who are then liable for the tax?
And that's where I think it's important to keep in mind the way corporations are taxed is the market-based, and that's for services and intangibles, and this is a very high-profile intangible, and that's that market-based, and where is the consumer? And that is one of the things that's different. When this discussion started back in 2014, mm-hmm. for services and intangibles, our corporate tax structure was cost of performance. And so that had a significant impact, in my opinion, on this kind of policy. Now, for just 2 years now, we've been under market-based. Now, there are a lot of questions under market-based, and Kate mentioned how many rules there are on the topic. And the more discussions the legislature has and the committee has about market-based sourcing, the better we'll become familiar with that. But that's the backdrop, I think,
mm-hmm.
and the context for future discussions.
Anything else?
Any other questions or comments?
Mm-mm.
Thank you very much for this presentation. Is there anything else you wanted to review with us for this topic today?
I don't think so, unless there are other questions.
So we're just waiting to get this bill right now.
Yes, and we thought it would be helpful to have a refresher.
Good.
Because it is complicated, and as you think about it, I'm sure more questions will come to mind.
Yes, go ahead, and then Ken Geyer.
So we are in an unusual spot in the session right now. If this bill doesn't pass, we revert to audience factor. How much of an issue is that?
What was my exact question?
For taxpayers, there are some who like that and some who don't. And so for some who like it, that's fine. And they, even if this were to pass,
yeah,
they would probably opt for that.
Whatever, right.
But there are those other businesses that would prefer the policy that's in here to audience. So if this weren't to become law, we'd have 2020 under that scenario. And then I would assume that those stakeholders would bring back the issue in 2021. And at that point, in all likelihood, it would be a matter of changing it for 2021 forward, or there potentially could be a retroactive piece.
Anything else, Representative Kenny Geyer?
Mm-mm, that was my question, too.
Okay. Thank you all. That concludes our business. We're adjourned.